Shout out to Christine de Pizan, the first paid female writer that anyone knows about. She lived in the early 1400s and wrote about her very happy marriage of 10 years. In one of her poems, she offers a rare description of a medieval wife's happiness in bed. But, you know, to me, it sort of sounded like, well, let me read you a part of it. A sweet thing is marriage. I can prove it certainly from my own experience. It's true for anyone with a good and wise husband, like the husband God helped me find. The first night of our marriage, I saw right away his great worth. For he did nothing to give me offense or pain. He kissed me 100 times without demanding any base act. Certainly the dear man loves me well. So in other words, let me get this straight, Christine. This dreamy man not only did nothing to give you offense or pain, but also did not demand any base act? Pinch me, I must be dreaming. Talk about damning with faint praise. I mean, I'm sorry to raid on your parade, first female writer ever, but aren't you setting kind of a low bar for yourself? On the other hand, it was the Middle Ages, so I guess she was lucky he wasn't beating her with a stick. In the Middle Ages, sex outside of marriage was universally considered sinful, and desire or pleasure were not supposed to play a role in relationships, though the church thoughtfully provided instructions for marital coitus in a treatise entitled De Secretis Mulierum, which suggests first emptying the bowels and the bladder, followed by fondling of the lower parts, in order to raise the female's body heat to the correct temperature, and then when the wife begins, quote, to speak as if she were babbling, unquote, the husband should know to make his move. And by his move, I assume they mean read to her from Genesis. By the way, the same book claims a woman can get pregnant by sharing bathwater with a man, which can only mean it's so murky and dense it's really more of a bisque or a pudding than it is a bath. So babbling is really the only reasonable response. Meanwhile, over in China, Chinese law gave a man the right to divorce his wife. But guess what? She had no such right. The accepted grounds for divorce were failure to bear a son, evidence of being unfaithful, lack of filial piety to the husband's parents, theft, suffering from an infectious disease, jealousy, and talking too much. In fact, the Chinese alphabet characters for good wife translate literally as great domestic assistant. A good Chinese woman lived by the three obediences: obey your father before marriage, obey your husband when married, and obey your sons in widowhood, which is a lot to ask of even a mediocre domestic assistant. Chinese men usually had only one wife, but collected as many courtesans as they could afford. And the courtesans would live permanently in the family home. And it was grounds for divorce if the lucky wife ever showed any jealousy to her husband's concubines. It was said there was a particularly horrible pit in hell reserved especially for jealous wives. Although whatever was going on in that pit was probably an improvement over the torture of having to be a great domestic assistant to your husband's multiple girlfriends. Here's a fun Chinese poem from the 3rd century by Fu Xuan. Bitter it is to have a woman's shape. It would be hard to name a thing more base. If it's a son born to the hearth and home, he comes to earth as if he's heaven sent. To breed a girl is something no one wants. She's not a treasure to her family. It actually wasn't until the late 1700s that we really begin to see rumblings in the West of familiar contemporary concepts like marital partnership. Doctors even began to tout the medical benefits of healthy relationships by claiming it was bad for a man's health for his wife to hate him. And so it came to pass that by the mid-1800s, popular opinion in Western Europe and North America shifted, and the idea of a love-based marriage where the wife stayed home and was supported by her husband was widely thought to be a little slice of heaven. Which, of course, didn't mean that Southern slave owners applied any of those heavenly principles to their slaves, who were permitted to breed, but not to legally marry. You know, so as not to disrupt the owner's ability to monetize the babies when they were finally old enough to sell. Ah, the wonders of the human being. No wonder I prefer the company of dogs. By the way, this crap continued even after emancipation. And now for my special closing present for Megan. A very special update on marital rape. Come with me now back to 1736, when British Chief Justice Matthew wrote in his History of the Pleas of the Crown that it was impossible for a husband to rape his wife because the marital agreement gave the husband a right of sexual access to his wife. Therefore, it bestowed an obligation on the wife to submit. Intercourse with one's husband was the obligation of the wife, period. In Hale's account, the difference between a wife and a prostitute is explained solely as a matter of jurisdiction. And by jurisdiction, he probably meant that prostitutes did better financially and had cuter outfits. In a related story about indignities, bride kidnapping and rape still occurs to this day in countries like Armenia, Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, and South Africa. There is a custom called ala kachuya, which means to take and run away, in which a groom forcibly takes a young woman or girl back to his home and then makes her write a letter of consent and then wear a marriage scarf over her head. This custom is now illegal, but apparently still really common. Here's a quote about it in an article in the New York Times in 2005 that I carry in my wallet as a reminder. When Aynur Tairova realized she was on her way to her wedding, she started choking the driver. This marriage was going to be to a man she had only met the day before, and briefly at that. Several of his friends had duped her into getting into the car. Once she was at his home, she knew her chances of leaving before nightfall were slim, and by daybreak, according to a local custom, she would have to submit to being his wife. Once a girl has been kept in his home overnight, her virginity is suspect and her name disgraced. Therefore, she will find it difficult to attract any other husband. Kyrgyz men say they snatch women because it's easier than courtship and cheaper than paying the standard bride price, which can be as much as $800 plus a cow. Talant Bakhtiyev, 34, a graduate student at the university named Bishkek, the capital, said he helped kidnap a bride for his brother. Men steal women to show that they're men, he said, revealing a row of gold-capped teeth with his smile. In a documentary on the subject, there's a scene of a family mourning a daughter who hanged herself after being kidnapped. They were unsuccessful in bringing her abductors to trial. Brutal as the custom is, it's widely perceived as practical. And now for the money quote. As a famous Kyrgyz saying goes, every good marriage begins in tears. Which sounds exactly like my aunt, who I quoted at the beginning of this piece, who told me, not a day goes by that he doesn't make me cry. Thank you, Auntie. May the circle be unbroken.
Hey, thanks for the bulletin on marital rape, by the way. I finally feel seen.
My pleasure.
I mean, the pleasure's all
the pleasure
anyone
is
who's not getting raped. You think Epicurus is credited as the writer of If You Want to Be Happy? That Jimmy Soul song about how you should marry an ugly chick if you want to be happy? Because if not, I mean, I feel like his estate is owed a lot in royalties.
No, but he does have a co-writer credit on I Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones. Not many people know that.
When women would get divorced in ancient times and their husband got to keep the kids, doesn't that kind of seem like the man's getting the raw end of that deal? Although, you know, he probably got one of his female slaves to be on diaper duty, of course, but
well,
still.
Not really. I mean, kids were, you know, if you had a garage sale in those days, kids were the first item to go.
Mm.
They actually sold kids.
Well, right, because they were assets, they not got liabilities, right?
Yeah, I guess they were assets.
You got them to toil
they were
the
both
fields.
Assets and liabilities in those days, but you'd have to put a price tag on them and they'd stand there and the next thing you know, gone.
I didn't know they had adhesive in those days to make price tags. That, was it De Secretis Mulierum? Is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't believe that told men that they should engage in foreplay with their wives before having sex, like 1,000 years ago. What happened in the 1,000-year interim between then and now that made guys not care where the clit is?
Well, you know, I have noticed, I mean, with regard to where things are on a woman, I have noticed that a lot of guys I know can take a computer apart or a refrigerator and put it back together and just completely have no idea where exactly anything is on a woman. It's like a big mystery. It's like they got on the right freeway, they got off at the wrong exit.
How many men do you interact with that are just dismantling refrigerators?
Hundreds.
I think that might have something to do with their emotional maturity level.
Well, have you ever seen my backyard? It's nothing but dismantled refrigerators.
I'm the one who's married, but he can act as if he were single. He wouldn't dream of wearing a wedding ring, no matter how much I tell him I like it. But I'm as good as he is. I've got a brain of my own, and I intend to make the most of my life, too. Yes, I want a home and kids, but I'm not going to be a fool like Mother, bending over a washtub all her life while Dad went around as free as air. A woman's place is in the home. Why, His Highness ought to wear side whiskers and carry a gold-headed cane. If he thinks I'm going to obey his every command, he can get right out of my life, and I mean it, right out of my life.
I mean, can you blame a husband for thinking his wife should obey his every command? Hell, even the Bible says wives should obey their husbands in everything, just as the church people obey Christ, an edict that continued to act as legally binding from the founding of America to pretty much the middle of the 20th century. Suffragist Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony's Declaration of Sentiments, given at the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention of 1848, outlined what was then being robbed of married women in the U.S. Amongst other indignities, they had no property rights, yet still had to pay property taxes. Their husbands could beat them with impunity. Divorce and child custody laws favored men, giving no rights to women. And in the covenant of marriage, a woman was compelled to promise obedience to her husband, he becoming, to all intents and purposes, her master. Which was what, of course, made things like our good friend marital rape legal until the 1970s. In his 1884 book, Lady's Guide in Health and Disease, Girlhood, Maidenhood, Wifehood, Motherhood, Dr. John Kellogg, who, when he wasn't giving advice to women, invented cornflakes, he was a real Renaissance man, declared, "Many a woman is by her marriage vow introduced to a slavery far more galling and vastly more debasing than that which cost this nation years of civil war and hundreds of thousands of lives to abolish. Of all the rights to which a woman is entitled, that of the custody of her own body is the most indubitable." The first American conviction for spousal rape may not have happened until 1979, but it did happen. A fact President Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, probably should have known before he proclaimed, "There's very clear case law that states you cannot rape your spouse." Oh, you don't remember when he said that because the past 2 years have been a daily series of newer, fresher hells? Allow me to explain. When it came out during the campaign that Trump's ex-wife Ivana referred to an incident that occurred between them in 1989 as rape, Cohen said, "You're talking about the front runner for the GOP, presidential candidate, as well as a private individual who never raped anybody. And, of course, understand that by the very definition, you can't rape your spouse." Now, I don't mean to brag or nothing,
but I've been maritally raped.
Which is pretty surprising, as I never thought I was going to get married in the first place. Until, that is, I did. I got out early enough for the experience to have not completely ruined my life. The fact that I married young, arguably too young, helped. Were I to come of age in the colonial era, however, I, a directionless 24-year-old at the time of my nuptials, would have been considered over the hill. Before these states were united, a girl need only be 12 and a boy 14 to legally marry. These ages were established by English common law and its definition of when each sex reached puberty. Apparently, the only requirement to be a husband in those days was a pair of dropped balls, and the only requirement to be a wife, a millimeter of breast tissue. The ages of sexual consent and marriage in the United States, unlike Marilynized periods, have never synced up.
In the late 1800s, most states set their age of consent at 10 to 12.
In Delaware, it was 7. Thanks to the efforts of female reformers at the time, who, in spite of the fact that they couldn't yet vote, still gathered tens of thousands of signatures and lobbied male officials, the age of consent was ultimately raised to 16, 17, or 18 in almost all states by the beginning of the 20th century. While 18 is now the legal age of marriage in most states, 21 states don't even have a minimum marriageable age. The laws in all but one still allow minors to marry with parental approval. Side note, shout out to Delaware, who became the first state to ban child marriage entirely this year, probably in an attempt to make up for that whole, "Sure, you can make it with a 7-year-old, we don't mind, we're not uptight" thing. Over 200,000 minors, 90% of which were girls, have gotten married over the past decade. Most were 16 or 17, but girls as young as 12 have been granted marriage licenses in Alaska, Louisiana, and South Carolina. Almost all married non-minors. Some married men in their 40s, 50s, and even 60s. But hey, the heart wants what it wants, am I right? The old biblical rule that a woman must be a virgin on her wedding night has, for centuries, been used as an excuse for girls to marry early, and is still used by religious folk as justification for not completely banning child marriage. Their argument is that if, say, a 12-year-old can't marry a man 2 to 5 times her age, she might engage in premarital sex, presumably with someone not old enough to rent a car. While the average woman today marries at the age of 27, in the early 1900s, most married at 22. In the 50s and 60s, that age decreased to 20. Although the number of women who marry by 35 has fallen over the past few decades, the same amount of women form unions, either through marriage or cohabitation, as they did 50 years ago. Marriage is increasingly becoming an institution of the elite, with women who have completed higher education more likely to marry by age 45 and less likely to divorce. Marriage rates have also diverged by race since the 60s, with non-whites less likely to have ever been married than whites. And speaking of race as it relates to marriage, in 1664, Maryland passed a law banning marriage between whites and slaves, ordering that any white woman who marries a black man would become enslaved herself, as would whatever children the two had together. In 1691, the Commonwealth of Virginia banned all interracial marriages, threatening to, quote, banish and remove whites who married people of color from the Commonwealth. This exile was, in practice, basically a death sentence. As slavery began to be abolished in the 1800s, some states repealed interracial marriage laws. In 1883, however, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that state-level bans on interracial marriage didn't violate the 14th Amendment, which banned slavery. In 1922, a xenophobic Congress, tired of just punishing people who married American people of color, passed the Cable Act, also known as the Married Women's Independent Nationality Act, which retroactively stripped any female U.S. citizen who married a, quote, alien ineligible for citizenship of her own citizenship. The law was designed to specifically discriminate toward Asians as, at the time of its passage, Asian aliens were not considered eligible for American citizenship. It should also be noted that, previous to the passage of the Cable Act, women gave up their U.S. citizenships if they married male foreigners, as they assumed the citizenship of their husbands. This law didn't apply to male citizens who married foreign women, almost predicting how big the international mail-order bride market would eventually become at the end of the century. Anti-miscegenation laws were not declared unconstitutional until a 1967 Supreme Court decision. The last state to still have such laws on the books was Alabama, which voted it out in the year 2000. In even yet still more depressing news, it passed with only 60% of the vote. Oh, you're not depressed enough at this point? What are you, a sadist? All right, let's talk about gay marriage. After the Supreme Court declined to hear the case of a same-sex couple who applied for a marriage license in the early 70s, the decision of whether or not to allow same-sex couples to marry was put in the hands of states, which began enacting laws explicitly defining marriage as the union between a man and a woman. The Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed into law by then-President Bill Clinton in 1996, didn't outright ban gay marriage, but specified that only heterosexual couples could be granted federal marriage benefits, which meant that, even if a state made it legal, same-sex married couples couldn't file joint income taxes, receive spousal Social Security benefits, or sponsor their spouses for immigration. In 2004, the Senate blocked a constitutional amendment supported by then-President George W. Bush that would have outlawed gay marriage nationwide. Throughout the decade, however, more and more states enacted laws that banned it. Inching towards marriage equality involved chipping away at DOMA, which was dismantled piece by piece until finally struck down by a Supreme Court decision in 2015 that required all states to finally issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And since we're talking about marriage, we may as well talk about divorce. Before California became the first state to allow no-fault divorce, when then-Governor Ronald Reagan signed the Family Law Act of 1969, divorce based on irreconcilable differences was impossible. By the way, Ronald Reagan later went on to become America's first and, sadly given the context, best divorced president. Until then, a divorce could only be obtained through showing the fault of one, and only one, of the parties in a marriage. In New York, adultery was the only grounds for divorce. Many couples would engage in something called collusive adultery to end their marriages, a deception in which the wife would walk in on the husband at a predetermined time and discover him in bed with another woman who had specifically been hired for the occasion. In other states, especially California, the most popular justification used for divorce was cruelty. Illinois had a very specific rule for what constituted it. One must strike their marriage partner in the face exactly twice without provocation, leaving visible marks. Because everyone knows a marriage is salvageable if the guy doesn't give you a black eye when he hits you. That's just marriage 101. But what of women who never wanted to become married in the first place? In the late 19th century, it was okay for a woman to remain an unmarried spinster, as the loss of male life in the Civil War had substantially lessened the pool of eligible bachelors. By the mid-20th century, however, the rise of the nuclear family made marriage societally compulsory. 4 out of 5 people surveyed in 1957 believed that preferring to remain single was, quote, sick, neurotic, or immoral. Change came in the 60s when unmarried women started entering college and the workforce, which meant they were no longer dependent on marriage for financial security. In much the same way women were seen as insane for not wanting to marry in the mid-20th century, they were also seen as such if they didn't want to procreate. The average woman born in 1900 would only live to 50 and continue to have kids until menopause. If she survived to old age, she'd probably spend her golden years acting as a live-in babysitter to her son or daughter. In the 50s and 60s, the typical woman had 3 children, completing her family before the age of 30. The norms are changing.
A 2010 Pew Research report showed that childlessness has risen across all racial and ethnic groups, with around 1 in 5 American women ending their childbearing years maternity-free, which compares to 1 in 10 in the 1970s. The birth rate in the U.S. is now the lowest in recorded American history, yet women are still seen as selfish for not wanting kids. The male, naturally, author of a 2013 New York Times op-ed piece entitled "More Babies, Please," argued that the retreat from child-rearing is, at some level, a symptom of late modern exhaustion, an example of decadence that reveals a spirit that privileges the present over the future. The stigmatization of women who choose to remain childless could be seen as a byproduct of capitalism. After all, consumerism is a huge part of motherhood. If a woman isn't buying for her family, there's less to market to her. In the 1960s, time-saving appliances were mass-produced and heavily marketed to housewives who held the household's pocketbooks. Women's magazines, all of which were edited by men, would heavily push the time-saving virtues of washing machines. Yet still, housewives of the era spent more time on laundry than in the 20s, when women were washing clothes by hand, because suburbanites bought more clothes and washed them more often. In the 1950s, the average household laundry went from 39 to 65 pounds a week. Former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy wrote in her high school yearbook that her ambition was to not be a housewife, which didn't mean she wanted a career per se. It meant she wanted to marry well enough to not have to clean. A 1964 Department of Labor Women's Bureau report called "To Benefit Women at Work" declared, "It is not the policy of the Women's Bureau to encourage married women and mothers of young children to seek employment outside the home. Home and children are considered married women's most important responsibilities." Sadly, the economy soon prevented many women from having only one unpaid job. After World War II, 60% of American families reached middle class. As the economy slowed in the 70s, however, women working became more of a necessity. In the 1970s, wives who worked provided, on average, one-third of their family's incomes. Growing up with a mother who worked for a wage and a father who did his share of the household chores, I never believed a woman's place was in the home, shoelessly toiling over a hot stove. Times have changed since Dr. Charles Meigs, in a 19th-century lecture to male gynecology students, declared a woman reigns in the heart. The household altar is her place of worship and service. She has a head almost too small for intellect and just big enough for love. I've just got to ask, fellas, does head size really matter? Indeed, one of the biggest achievements of the feminist movement was helping to shift the centuries-old view that a woman's role as nothing but the den mother of her household was divinely ordained, and instead show that opportunities existed outside her gilded prison. But don't get too excited, working girls. Married women still earn significantly less than unmarried ones, despite the fact that married men earn 10 to 40% more than their single counterparts. And the household division of labor is still insufferably, infuriatingly gendered. Women are entering the workforce in larger numbers, but still do the lion's share of domestic labor, even if they've pulled off the magic trick of making as much or more money than their husbands. An indignity the sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild refers to as the second shift. When researching her 1989 book of the same name, she found that mothers in the workforce, when factoring in both their paid jobs and unpaid jobs of housework and childcare, worked an average of 1 month of 24-hour days a year more than their husbands. A 2013 report by the Pew Research Center found that fathers have, on average, around 3 hours more leisure time per week than mothers, a leisure gap that has been consistent over the past decade. And speaking of working mothers getting fucked in more ways than one, until the passage of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, women could legally be fired for becoming pregnant. The act actually ended up slowing the wage growth of married women of childbearing age, mostly because employers shifted the increased cost of insuring pregnant women to the women themselves. Thanks, fellas. Today, the United States lags behind its global partners in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in providing basic accommodations for parenthood and paid leave. The 1993 Family and Medical Leave Act requires employees to provide up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave to new parents. In the other countries that make up the OECD, the average is 80 weeks of leave, which includes 33 weeks of full-time paid leave. As for the FMLA, more like FML, am I right, ladies? One study found it might actually reduce the likelihood that a woman who takes unpaid leave is promoted. Which leads me to one of my favorite acronyms, which I really should get embroidered on a tea towel one of these days. TGII. Thank God I'm infertile.
So Kellogg's cereal is the cereal of the liberator? I mean, this guy was like a big feminist?
No, he was just like the kind of guy that liked telling people that they were living their lives wrong. He was really into clean living. And I mean, also don't get too excited about him as like a feminist icon or anything. He also advocated for applying carbolic acid to a woman's clitoris to get her to stop masturbating.
Is that true?
That is true, yeah. He was really into, you know, not jerking it.
Maybe he just had a lot of carbolic acid and just had no way of really moving it.
He just had a garage full of it?
Yeah. He just thought, what else can I do with this? So you managed to work marital rape into this again, too.
I mean, you know, when you love what you do, you never work a day in your life, right?
That's right.
And like I said, Audible gave us that quota.
Oh, gee, you know, I didn't know about that quota.
Well, that's why you got to read the contract.
So you're a marital rapee.
I have been maritally raped, which is why I can make jokes about it.
Yeah.
The same way, you know, rappers can use the N-word because they've experienced racism before.
Yeah. I'm an assault victim myself, but I'm an OG style victim.
Oh, so you've been like classic raped, like just raped
by
a stranger?
I wasn't. I wasn't married.
Right. Yeah, that's like the Coke classic of rape. And I got new Coke raped, I guess.
I guess so. Also, I like that guy Charles Meig, a head too small for intellect, but just big enough for love. Now, talk about something that belongs on a tea towel. You know, in fact, you and I ought to trademark that as soon as this session is over.
We have a lot to do after this.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. I think we're going to make a lot of money off of that. Is he dead, Charles Meig?
To me, he is, yeah.
Chapter 6, Body Image.
The great dietitian Bill Banting, his wife every day he would weigh. If you live on celery, you'll burn more calories, putting my laundry.
Well, this is a chapter we ought to be able to write in our sleep because we're both experts in body-based self-loathing. So I feel like we're really going to impress everyone with the breadth of our knowledge about this.
I mean, I just want to say right now, whoever has the most harrowing eating disorder story has to buy the other one a full-calorie Coke. I'm setting that up right now.
I haven't had a full-calorie Coke since I was about 8 years old. I've already got the world record for never ordering my own dessert. In fact, every dessert I've ever eaten has been ordered by someone else for themselves.
Well, I've convinced myself I don't even like dessert, so
well, that's very,
I'm kicking
very
your ass.
Devilishly clever of you.
We should take this point to remind everybody who's still listening, assuming we still have listeners, that there is going to be a quiz at the end of the book. So make sure that you're paying complete attention to all of the harrowing tales of purging that Meryl's about to tell you about.
I don't want to disappoint anyone, but I'm not actually telling any tales of purging in this. Though I am telling something nearly as disgusting, in fact, maybe more disgusting. It seemed like quite enough to just admit that there has been purging in my life, really.
Well, but we're like white women in America. If we didn't have eating disorders, wouldn't we just be deported? Or like round up and put into one of Melania's fat camps or something?
That's just a rumor, right? She doesn't really have fat camps, does she? I mean, I heard that Trump is sending ICE agents door to door looking for women who aren't beauty pageant ready and then burying them alive.
I think that was on InfoWars, right? Well, I heard he's going to build a wall around all the chicks that refuse to go to the gym and make them pay for it.
Uh-oh, because, you know, I go to the gym. And that whole idea of there being a city with slothful women walled in sounds like a place I might want a condo, so and I wouldn't be eligible.
Well,
hope that's not true.
There's no time like the present to throw that 24-hour fitness membership into the garbage.
All right, then. That's what I'm going to go home and do.
Fantastic. Let's not even record the chapter. I think you need to do this now.
All right, I'm leaving.
Okay, bye.
Part of the fun of being a human involves living up to physical expectations of other humans. And if you're a female human, oh, what expectations they've always been. If you were a 5-year-old girl growing up in China anytime between the 10th and the 20th century, your parents would have bound your feet in a way that would have caused you to be crippled for the rest of your life, creating great pain by forcing your toes to grow underneath the ball of your foot in order to keep the total length of your foot under 4 inches. This was explained as the required foot length for finding a husband, an idea started by some 10th century aristocrat who thought that crippling a woman to prevent her from running away was sexy, which is why we must never let the incels take over the shoe industry. Believe it or not, it took until 1912 for the newly formed Republic of China to finally ban this grisly practice. On the other hand, if you were a 5-year-old girl growing up in a certain tribe in Southeast Asia or Africa, you would have been fitted with a series of neck-elongated brass rings, weighing up to 10 pounds, that you would wear all your life, even though they weakened your neck, moved your rib cage and collarbones 45 degrees below where they normally should be, and caused your shoulders to slope forward. And this, too, would have been explained as a good idea because someone in the 11th century decided it was a perfect way for you to show your faithfulness, which apparently was an 11th century euphemism for orthopedic disaster, but which probably also had something to do with that elusive but much desired thing called finding a husband. But wait, the fun isn't over. If you were a 5-year-old girl growing up in the Western Sahara, Morocco, or Mauritania, women known as fatteners would have begun to force feed you, threatening you with pain if you didn't drink your daily 5 gallons of milk and eat your 4 pounds of millet mixed with 2 cups of butter, because fat was a sign of wealth. And so this, and not broken feet or a distended neck, was truly the key to finding a husband. This practice, called Le Bleu, was also started in the 11th century, which is definitely shaping up as one of the best centuries for breakthroughs in the science of husband finding. Though as luck would have it, Le Bleu apparently made a comeback in Mauritania after a military junta in 2008, and not a moment too soon. Then again, if you were a little girl in the 3rd century being raised in the Catholic Church, St. Jerome and his minions would have reminded you to regard your own body as such a minefield, you were supposed to blush and feel overcome every time you experienced your own nakedness, which is why no virgin of full age was ever supposed to bathe. And an attractive woman was advised to maintain a look of unpleasant filth in order to help saintly men avoid impure thoughts. Apparently, filth was the original burqa. Kind of an improvement, since at least you could see when you were crossing the street. What I'm saying is that pretty much every century on every continent has been a crazy, uncomfortable obstacle course full of weird, irrational customs for human women with regard to their bodies. By the Middle Ages, if you managed not to be burned as a witch, you had no choice but to play along with your region's version of this stuff. Women were physically smaller than men and therefore more easily coerced into dependency. In Europe in the 1700s, the physical weakness of girls was exacerbated by a downturn in the European economy that meant that female family members were given less to eat. At the same time, ignorant child-rearing practices prior to knowledge about the body's need for vitamin D from sunshine had mothers wrapping their babies up and keeping them indoors, allowing growth-stunting bone diseases like rickets to spread. I know very little about my family history on either side, except that some of them came to this country from Latvia or the Ukraine around 1900, running from genocide. Peasant cultures like the ones from which they escaped were traditionally set up to accommodate men and boys. A very insulting thing to say about a woman back then was, "She eats as much as a man." And that was the fun part. A woman ethnographer who lived in the German village before World War I recalled how, as a young bride, she was subject to the scrutiny of her mother-in-law and her other relatives, including her husband. Scrutiny, always the cornerstone of affection and intimacy. Two things, by the way, not on any newly married couple's agenda back then. For one thing, there was no time. At the end of the workday, all the husbands in a typical village went to the tavern, leaving the wives with the kids. Probably infuriating, but who knows. Also maybe a relief because, fun fact, a husband was more than just allowed to beat his wife. It was expected of him. It was practically a hobby, like fly fishing, something you got better at over time. I don't know if this behavior applied to any of my distant relatives. My parents weren't violent, just very critical of each other in a nagging way. Sort of like, "Jerry, I told you 15 minutes ago to put the coffee cups on the left side of the dishwasher." though lately I've been thinking about how my father's mother was one of the least revealed women I've ever met. Which is why, when I was in my 30s, I asked my father, "When you were growing up, what kind of personality did your mother have?" To which he answered, "Personality? She didn't have a personality. They didn't have them in those days." After my eyes stopped spinning in different directions, it occurred to me that maybe his crazy answer contained a grain of truth about how Eastern European working-class families raised their daughters in the late 1800s, which was around the time that the Industrial Revolution transformed a typical home from an agrarian center of production to a center of consumption. At the same time, modern medicine and food production caused a big jump in the number of physically bigger baby girls being born, a trend which continued until the 1960s, eventually creating a 5'9" behemoth like me, who outgrew her 4'10" grandmother by almost a full foot. Not only was I rickets-free, but I had pretty much constant access to cupboards full of Chips Ahoy, donut gems, Hershey's Kisses, and ice cream from 31 flavors, of which I had sampled all 31. At least until my annual checkup at age 11, when the family doctor suggested I take off a few pounds. The paranoia that rained down upon me that day, followed by a whole new take on relentless name-calling from my brother, reshaped my life irrevocably. I don't know why everyone around me was ignoring Dr. Spock, the pediatrician with the best-selling book on childcare at that time, who was on record as saying, "Mild overweight is common in children between 7 and 12 and likely to vanish by 15 without great effort." Because that was what happened. About a year later, it evened out when I grew 8 inches taller. But by then it was too late. I was trapped in the terrifying quicksand of a girl who had gained weight, and it haunted me like a slobbering incubus for the whole rest of my life. From that moment until just a few minutes ago when someone here at this recording studio offered me a menu, there's never been one single moment where I ordered the thing I actually wanted to eat. That doctor's appointment marked the day I was swept into a treacherous tornado of salad with a funnel cloud full of spinning diet books and pre-made diet preparations, beginning with the purchase of a 4-inch pocket calorie guide at the market, which explained that a piece of celery was, wow, only 6 calories. But a chocolate chip cookie was, 450 billion. And because I'm a fastidious pursuer of my dreams, by college I had a full-blown eating disorder, with celery the entree of choice for most meals. Had I only grown up in the 1840s in that small German village with the family of that woman ethnographer, anorexia might never have found me. In addition to potatoes, that woman recounted, sometimes for dinner there would be a herring. My father would take half and give the other half to my mother, who would divide it up among us 4 children. If you didn't get enough, well, there was plenty of salt in the salt shaker to eat. How could this poor hungry family have guessed they were living my dream? Access to unlimited snacks like salt that were 0 calories. I didn't know it yet, but my psychological profile was cliché anorexic, young female struggling against an unyielding authority figure, in many cases the mother, also lacking in the requisite autonomous sense of self, and an inability to master separation from family. This last one really rang true. Freshman year in college, I often heard my own thoughts being spoken to me in the voice of my mother in a bad mood. Like every good anorexic, the amount of food I didn't eat was the one thing over which I had some control. My goal was to achieve a look in which each of my ribs was clearly visible, like an actress who I saw lying around naked in an Andy Warhol movie. I was never hospitalized because I supplemented my lack of food with the miracle of intoxicating beverages, which turned out to be a menu plan so versatile it could serve as breakfast, lunch, dinner, and a bedtime snack. And, as far as I could tell, the only side effect was increased cuteness. How was I to know that obsessive weight loss screws up your fertility? Though, had I known, I would have celebrated any chance to save money on birth control. This was the year I lived on 450 calories a day eating Metrical cookies, a popular 1960s meal replacement that tasted exactly like sawdust, a comparison I was equipped to make since sawdust was one of my favorite low-cal snacks. You were supposed to eat 9 Metrical cookies a day, but I quickly cut that number in half, knowing in my heart that anything calling itself a cookie could not be trusted. And that was before my new college pals showed me the most essential dieting tool of all, throwing up. It was something I was instantly good at, just like I wasn't making snide remarks. What a revelation! Like realizing you could close your overstuffed suitcase after all if you simply removed 1 bulky sweater. Now the good news. As I got older, I got saner. Well, actually, this bullshit went on for years, as these things tend to do. Recent statistics say 70 million people worldwide have an eating disorder, and it's girls of all races, religions, and cultures who are 10 times more likely to have one. This includes girls in Muslim and Orthodox Jewish enclaves whose lives are dominated by male dictates. However, eating disorders in these groups are so taboo they usually go untreated. Anorexia nervosa didn't exist in its current form until 1873, when a rising number of cases began to be recorded in the United States, England, and France. But it existed in slightly different forms among mostly females since the Middle Ages, its popularity ebbing and flowing depending on economic hardship and male cultural domination, sort of like the popularity of Transformer movies. Its historical precedent was called anorexia mirabilis, which involved young fasting women questing not for thinness, but for purity. Though these days, if a young woman said she was starving herself as a way to communicate with Christ, healthcare professionals would still call it anorexia nervosa. Some of these mirabilis ladies became famous enough to have their own Wikipedia pages, like Angela of Foligno in the late 1200s, also Catherine of Siena in the 1300s, whose illness began as a teenage protest against an arranged marriage to her late sister's husband. But I must add that neither of these girls ever suffered as much as I did when I read the following sentence describing their behavior. They both refused food but drank the pus from the sores of the sick. Angela of Foligno is reported to have said it was as sweet as the Eucharist, and also to have eaten the scabs and lice from those same patients, though precious little else. I inflicted this on you just in case you were debating whether their spirituality goals were part of the miracle of Jesus or bona fide mental problems. These days, although we still dote on unachievable levels of skinniness, there are some variety of body types sneaking into the media here and there. As there should be, since we are long overdue. Desirable body image has been ever-shifting throughout the centuries. The oldest known sculptural representations of women from 35,000 years ago were of big women. Really big. Like the famous Venus of Willendorf. I'm sorry, Mrs. Willendorf, but if that carving actually resembled you, you were stacked but obese. Same goes for plenty of the women of ancient Egypt, though you'd never know it from looking at the supermodels that populated their hieroglyphics. According to the New York Times, a posthumous analysis of the mummy of Queen Hatshepsut, one of two known female pharaohs, shows her to be an obese, diabetic, 50-year-old woman with bad teeth. And apparently most Egyptian mummies shared these same physical traits. Think about that next time you hear "walk like an Egyptian." Of course, unsurprisingly, the ancient Greeks were the first to label obesity a medical disorder in 450 BC, then mock it by making the fat character in every Greek comedy a glutton and an object of ridicule. Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, got this ball rolling when he wrote, "Corpulence is not only a disease itself, but the harbinger of others." He recommended a diet of light foods, slow running, hard work, wrestling, seawater enemas, walking about naked, and vomiting after lunch, which sounds eerily like every show business party I've ever attended. Leave it to the Greeks to take it upon themselves to nail down the math of physical attractiveness, with Pythagoras deciding that the face had to be perfectly symmetrical, and then Plato chiming in that it should also be two-thirds as wide as it was high. Just taking a moment to thank and credit these guys for helping eating disorders become a multi-century success by creating a foolproof way for women to pinpoint their shortcomings. It's been so effective that not one woman I've ever met is happy with how she looks, which may have been what those mostly misogynistic guys were going for. So kudos, ancient classical Greeks, you sons of bitches. By the 2nd century, famous Roman physician Galen had begun treating clinical cases of morbid obesity, which he defined as being unable to walk without sweating, unable to reach the table when you're sitting due to the size of your stomach, showing difficulty breathing, and cleaning yourself, all of which sound like our current president, and also trouble giving birth, which indicates who a lot of Dr. Galen's clientele must have been. There were also brief periods of relief from the insanity of all this perfectionism. For example, during the Tang Dynasty, women with plump figures, round faces, big cheeks, and wide foreheads were considered the most beautiful. Ditto the Renaissance, thanks to painters like Rubens and Caravaggio, both who immortalized women of larger sizes. Though elsewhere, around the same time, fat was still being associated with evil. In the book Malleus Maleficarum, the definitive treatise on witchcraft, written in 1487 by a Catholic clergyman. The illustrations show overweight witches with bulging bellies and big, heavy breasts possessed of such formidable sexuality that they could shoot fire out of their vaginas, a trick that, sadly, all too few of us can do anymore, which may be for the best because it's very hard on the underwear. Unsurprisingly, by the mid-1700s, the ideal of feminine beauty was once again all about being slender. When industrialization led women, particularly from lower classes, back into the workplace, a woman who looked frail and ethereal became an upper-class demonstration of prosperity. By the time Queen Victoria ascended in 1837, the pale, weak look had become all the rage. No particular body part was emphasized. Women just weren't supposed to look too hardy or strong. So they eagerly lined up behind languid, melancholy poet Lord Byron to join him in his new vinegar diet. Plenty of vinegar daily, plus one cup of tea and one raw egg. Side effects included vomiting and diarrhea. A small price to pay for looking consumptive. I would have jumped on this one right away, but probably would have cut it down to half the egg, just to be on the safe side. In 1830, Sylvester Graham, father of the Graham cracker, became the first successful commercial dieting expert. A Presbyterian minister and early vegetarian, he believed people were fat because, yes, they ate wrong, but also because they had too much sex. He claimed his diet could cure both obesity and the desire to masturbate. Fortunately, nowadays we have calorie-burning charts that analyze every sexual position, with woman on top, or what is called cowgirl, coming in as the best fat burner at 122 calories per session. This data was made possible thanks to an American chemist named Atwater in the late 1880s, who was the first to reduce the world of behavior and food to something called calories and something else called vitamins by calculating how much fuel the body burned during various tasks. And once these innovative new discoveries were in place, women were able to board a faster, more efficient, more all-consuming bullet train to dieting hell. It was around this same time that society decided to be embarrassed for fat people. Which brings us to the 1860s, another sad day for female sanity, when William Banting invented the first low-carbohydrate weight loss diet. And presto, before you could say, "No fries, thanks, can I just get some sliced tomatoes instead?" companies began falling all over themselves, developing ways to market weight loss products for weight-obsessed women that contained laxatives, purgatives, arsenic, strychnine, thyroid hormones, amphetamines, and other unsafe ingredients, all of which the younger me would have eagerly swallowed without question in the hopes that eating the right amount of strychnine would help me achieve a more effective showcase for each and every one of my ribs at last.
Five-year-old girls being forced to drink 5 gallons of milk a day, that's only a gallon per year they've been alive. That doesn't really seem like that big of a deal.
Well, I guess they have to keep it up until they get married, which, you know, all things considered, probably is at 8. So that would mean 8 gallons a day, which would come to about $30, which is still less than a grilled vegetable salad at the Ivy in Beverly Hills. So, you know, good value, too.
Well, we don't know if the milk was organic or not, because if so, you're going to need to tack on a couple extra bucks per gallon minimum.
I guess that's why we don't do La Blue here in the States.
That's probably the only reason why.
It probably is.
Hey, you know, twinsies, I know almost nothing about my family history on either side either. It's almost like our parents are too self-absorbed to acknowledge, I don't know, the existence of their own ancestors, or...
Well, a good narcissist can work with ancestry and improve it, like the Trump family did when they changed their name from Drumpf to Trump in order to add a little Swedish ancestry, even though it didn't exist in real life. Just the pure creativity of that family, they were able to add it.
I find that really... Yeah, I've assumed my family, by insisting on pronouncing our last name Keister instead of Kester, just wanted to make sure that every future generation was the butt of every joke. It's very similar.
That was very, very considerate of them.
Yes, they're kind people. So, how many carbs do you think are in pus? Zero? Is that why, you know, those gals Kathy and Angie ate it, or what?
You know, I've never seen it listed on a calorie counter, I'm sad to say. But semen is said to have 7 calories a teaspoon. And I know that because I keep a teaspoon on my night table to make sure I'm not over-consuming. It's apparently full of fructose.
Overindulging,
yeah.
I guess you should say. Well, yeah. That's why whenever I swallow, I always insist on taking a run around the block immediately afterward.
You are working too hard. I just roll onto the floor and start doing sit-ups.
I was amazed that she wasn't engaged by now. She was prettier than ever.
The number ones are good. Let's have two of those, please. Make my number three, if you don't mind. I don't see how you can eat so much so early in the morning.
Are you on a diet, by any chance?
Of course I am, and you should be, too. Every morning I exercise for 10 minutes. You can start right in tomorrow.
Look, let's get this straight right now. You starve and you exercise. I eat and I watch you exercise.
But it's really as necessary for you as for everybody else.
Like Meryl, I've also had an eating disorder because I'm a white woman in America and that's the law. I remember the peak of my disorder well as one can remember anything when their sustenance-deprived brain is operating at quarter capacity. I was living in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit and had to evacuate. I traveled to Minnesota, as the sister of my boyfriend at the time lived there. In an impotent attempt at normalcy, we went to a mall, the Mall of America specifically, immediately after receiving debit cards loaded with emergency relief funds from the Red Cross. He used some of his to buy a Slayer shirt at Hot Topic. I used some of mine to purchase pants at American Eagle Outfitters. The size of the pants, not that you asked? Baby's first double zero, baby! I finally achieved my disease's goal of becoming nothing, times two! Feeling as though I'd won the anorexic lottery, any anxiety I had about whether my home was destroyed or my cat washed away dissipated completely. For many women, the desire to be thin supersedes any other feeling. It's ingrained in us since birth. The other day at a women's expo, I watched as an infant girl sat in the lap of her mother, who was intently listening to a presentation about the virtues of cool sculpting, a form of body contouring that entails the freezing of fat cells in lieu of getting them siphoned out through liposuction. I wondered how long it would take until the little girl started loathing her own body. Today's women are held to far higher standards of thinness than men and are subject to far greater punishments if they don't fit the bill, up to and including suffering in their careers. Research has shown the higher a woman's body mass, the less she earns in the workforce, and the fewer job opportunities open to her. In the Western world, thinness has also become an indicator of race-based class dynamics. Wealthier white women tend to be, on average, thinner than poor women of color because they have more access to healthy, unprocessed foods and more free time to work out. Yet obesity is seen as a character defect, symbolizing slothfulness and a lack of self-control. Oh, you didn't go to that $50 spin class you can't afford after pulling a double at Arby's, rushing home to make dinner, helping your kids with their homework, and washing four loads of laundry before eventually passing out for 5 hours and doing it all over again? What, are you lazy? If you're surprised when I tell you it hasn't always been like this, you haven't been paying attention. Which, again, is unfortunate, as there will be a test afterwards. Hopefully one of your woke friends has been listening and taking notes. What constitutes America's ideal female body type has changed so much over the years it's harder to keep track of than the plot of a David Lynch movie. The norm constantly oscillates between curvaceous and curveless, both of which are impossible to achieve if you're not born that way. But that doesn't mean you can't spend your whole life chasing an unachievable ideal! And when it comes to unachievable ideals, there's none more so than the idea that one can freeze time like fat. Our consumerist culture values young, thin, toned bodies. Every time a product is advertised or a show carried by a doe-eyed, sinewy 22-year-old girl, a 60-year-old woman gets her wings because she ceases to exist. A desire to still be seen, to exist, is what leads many women of age to preserve the costly appearance of youth. In much the same way a woman is viewed as weak or lazy if she doesn't maintain thinness, she is seen as positively incorrigible if she doesn't look young. For women, aging is presented as a problem that can be solved, be it through diet, exercise, surgery, or injecting botulism into your face. The double standard is that men age gracefully, becoming more distinguished as time passes. If a woman looks her age, however, and by her age I mean post-puberty, some sort of character defect is assumed. For proof of this, look at how mercilessly female celebrities are mocked by the press when they no longer appear to be 19, almost as much as they're mocked when they're photographed exposing one molecule of cellulite. Eliminating cellulite is basically as unachievable as the goal of never aging. And unlike the inevitable passage of time, the problem that is cellulite is a relatively recent invention, having only reached pandemic status in the mid-20th century. In 1968, Vogue magazine declared that, like a swift migrating fish, the word cellulite has suddenly crossed the Atlantic. Soon, the 80-90% of women who were affected by it became obsessed with fighting it. Today, it remains as untreatable as it's always been, but that doesn't stop women from continuing to hemorrhage millions of dollars on creams and contraptions.
But for the inception of modern America's obsession with thinness, we need to go back to the 1920s. Before then, only the very wealthy were able to weigh themselves or even see their bodies in their entireties, as both scales and full-length mirrors were prohibitively expensive to the lower classes. With the invention of bathroom scales and the rise of department stores replete with full-length mirrors, however, working-class women were finally given the opportunity to see themselves and all their myriad flaws, thus kicking off our lust for leanness. In the 20s, thinness was seen as the primary attribute of beauty, as evidenced by the epidemic of eating disorders that occurred amongst young women at the time. By 1925, the bust-to-waist ratios of women featured in Vogue and Ladies' Home Journal had decreased by 60% from the turn of the century. In 1921, the writer Nina Wilcox Putnam recommended that obesity made a legal misdemeanor. To stay fat is to throw away one's youth. It is an offense against oneself and against one's neighbor's sense of the beautiful. Her statement was, thankfully, satire, but like all good forms of it, contained a grain of truth. The time of my adolescence, the 90s, was an era in which sallow bags of bones vacantly stared at you from Calvin Klein ads,
which might have something to do with my quest for gauntness.
I'm so much of a 90s kid, I starved myself down to 90 pounds. Thin is still decidedly in, with most celebrities and models averaging 15% or less of their recommended body weight, which delightfully happens to be a major characteristic of anorexia. The body mass indexes of Miss America pageant winners has steadily decreased over the past century, reaching a low of 16.9 in the mid-2000s. According to the World Health Organization, normal BMIs fall between 18.5 and 24.9. A BMI below 17.5 is usually present in people suffering from anorexia. The thinner girls are expected to be, the more unsatisfied they are when they look in the mirror. A 2010 study conducted by the Girl Scouts of America found that 59% of the 13 to 17-year-old girls they surveyed were, quote, dissatisfied with their body shape. 66% wanted to lose weight, and 48% wished they were as skinny as the models they saw in fashion magazines. There is, indeed, little time left for that infant I saw sitting on her mother's lap. Body image is learned early, with kids aware of their bodily issues and attempting to control their appearance by the time they're preschoolers. Thin wasn't always in, of course. In the Victorian era, the ideal female form was a big-titted, long-legged, small-waisted, voluptuous hourglass figure. Thanks, corsets! Like thinness today, it was an indicator of class. Having a little extra cushion for the pushin' meant you didn't toil for a living or think too hard. If not pleasantly plump, an 1840 guide to proper femininity instructed women desirous of acquiring fullness to, quote, avoid all anxiety and endeavor to feel indifferent to every sensation, reflect as little as possible, and occupy herself with lively and agreeable subjects. Shun sitting up, gaming, all strong, afflicting, or turbulent passions, and all excesses. Sleep a long time, 10 hours at least, and when not asleep, rest as much as possible, listless, in dim light, talk little, and indulge in everything which tends to produce relaxation in the activity of the functions. They must not have known yet that breathing burns calories, otherwise I'm sure women would have been told to refrain from that, too. Some forms of plumpness, however, were unacceptable, specifically carrying baby weight. Because femininity was defined by a small waist in Victorian society, women wore maternity corsets while pregnant. These corsets also did double duty to mask the fact that, by virtue of being pregnant, they had engaged in the sex act, which no decent woman would ever admit to doing at the time. Lacings on the sides of corsets were designed to be loosened as a woman's baby bump grew, yet many kept them taut, their desires to maintain their hourglass shapes trumping the necessity to not constrain the life growing within them. Pregnancy is no longer taboo, yet women still work to hide it. Corsets have been replaced by pregnancy spanks, which, yes, exist, as you should never underestimate the depth of a woman's capacity for self-loathing, and it's now expected that the modern woman maintain her exercise routine during pregnancy. A Cosmopolitan article from 2017, entitled 10 Extremely Pregnant Women Working Out Like It's NBD, shows, well, extremely pregnant women, quote, killing it at the gym by, quote, strength training like a boss, and, quote, working on booty gains. And in a country in which dad bods are now fetishized, the postpartum body of a woman is seen as something that needs to be tightened up while the uterus is still warm. Mommy makeovers, which, according to a brochure from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, entail improving the breasts by replacing lost volume with breast implants, breast lifts if the, quote, position of the nipples have dropped too much, and tummy tucks and liposuction on excessively full fatty areas, is increasing in popularity. A survey by the ASPC reported that 62% of mothers would consider one such makeover if the cost, which ranges between 10 and 20 grand, wasn't an issue. The trade-off in improving your shape, the brochure bleakly states, is the addition of permanent scars on your body. And yet, it continues, you should do it for yourself, not to try and fit any sort of ideal image or to fulfill someone else's expectations. You hear that, ladies? Permanently scar yourself. For yourself. While the body of a woman suffused with the wonder and the power that is human life is, to be sure, nausea-inducing, so is the body of a woman who isn't. By which I mean to say, a menstruating one. The longer a gal can avoid it, the better. The 1888 book, The Physical Life of Women, Advice to the Maiden Wife and Mother, warned that menstruation started too young resulted in a feeble middle life. Causes of early menstruation included attending